Okay, so let us continue where we left off yesterday.
Yeah.
So we have just been starting to look at the idea of morality on the Buddhist path. So we're moving from right sankappa, which is like right aim or right intention or right purpose, and we're moving on to the factors which are sammakamanta, some right action, and sammavacha, right speech, the next factor on this path. And also right livelihood is also really part of the idea of right action. So that's also going to be part of this. Yesterday we talked a little bit about the general principles of ethics and morality in Buddhism, and how they are very flexible, and they're based on a very natural and kind of self-evident way of looking at morality. The idea that if you hurt somebody else, that's the main thing, or even if you hurt yourself, that is what is considered immoral in Buddhism. It's kind of very, very basic and very natural understanding of the idea of morality. And in the end, the way you decide whether you're doing something which is bad for others and bad for yourself is to know your intentions, know the motivations in your mind. What is driving you to do this particular act? This is what kind of decides the ethical significance of the action, if you like. And now I'm going to look in more detail about this, because there are various factors for each one of these sub-factors, for each of the factors of the path. So I'm going to look at these in a little bit of detail. So this is what happens next here. The Buddha says, having thus gone forth and possessing the bhikkhus or the bhikkhunis training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings with a rod and a weapon laid aside, conscientious, merciful, he abides compassionate to all living beings. So here we have person possessing the bhikkhus training and way of life, and this is just means that this particular training we're talking about now, the idea of the gradual training, especially, of course, also it also means the special rules and the vinaya and all of these things that is added for the monastics. But essentially, it means the gradual training. One of the interesting things about the monastic vinaya, because the monastic vinaya is, as I said, it's all the rules, but also all the procedures and all the all the little details about the ordinary life of monastics. And one of the interesting things about that is that it is really secondary. People think that this is kind of what monastic life is all about. But not really what monastic life is all about. It's actually the practice of the Dhamma, the gradual training and all of these things. And the Vinaya is a secondary thing which comes out of that. The Vinaya emerges from the Dhamma and not the other way around. The Dhamma is always primary. And the Vinaya, the rules or whatever we follow, are secondary. They emerge from the idea of Dhamma. So, and this is an important point, so you always take the Dhamma as your main reference point, and then the Vinaya kind of fits into the overall framework of what the Dhamma is about. And this makes an important distinction, because sometimes, if you have a lot of rules and all these kind of things, you can end up with a lot of fault-finding and blaming people. You're not keeping the rules, what are you doing? You're kind of bad monk or whatever. And then you end up actually creating bad karma, because you're not really following the Dhamma. You're kind of focusing so much on the rules that you forget about kindness, you forget about compassion. And this is kind of one of the dangers of being too rule-focused on the Buddhist path. The overall picture is far more important than individual rules and that sort of thing. So it's not that you don't correct somebody. You may correct somebody, but you have to do it. And again, it's about how you do that, how you correct somebody. This is by far the most important thing there. So that is what it means. The bhikkhu's training and way of life is precisely this training that we're looking at now. And then the first factor here is the abstaining from killing living beings. So that is very similar to the first precept, or the five precepts, almost verbatim the same thing. Then it adds something, and this additional thing is what makes it interesting to look at the gradual training here. It says, with rod and weapon laid aside, conscientious and merciful, you abide compassionate to all living beings. And this shows you, again, that the idea of ethics on the Buddhist path is not just a negative ethics that you shouldn't do certain things, it's also a positive ethics about what we actually should do. We should deliberately be compassionate and kind. We should deliberately support other people or other beings, animals, or whoever it really for that matter. And that then adds a very important dimension to the Buddhist idea of Buddhist ethics. Very often, if you avoid doing the bad, it means you don't have any regret, you don't have any remorse, you don't feel bad about yourself. So if you actually actively do good things, you actually feel actively good about yourself because you're living well. So both have a very important place on the Buddhist path. And it's really only when you do both that you are completely fulfilling the idea of ethical conduct. And that is when kind of the path really takes off, right? Because you're using every opportunity you have to do what is kind. Using every opportunity you have to turn your mind away from the kind of negative impulses, negative tendencies, and move them towards something positive instead. And if you do that, then things really start to take off in your Buddhist practice. So this is the first thing about this. There's two sides of the coin. But the other thing which is interesting here, of course, is this idea that the assumption here, right, is that either you kill or you are compassionate. That's the assumption. You can see you abstain from killing. That's the bad side. But then you are compassionate. So what about a situation where you, theoretically, a situation where you are both compassionate and you kill? What happens then? Because that kind of seems to... How does that fit into this kind of framework? Yeah. Let's assume for a second that it's possible to kill compassionately. Yeah. So where does that fit into this framework? Yeah. Is that right or is it wrong? Your killing seems to be wrong, but compassion seems to be right. So if you are both killing and compassionate, what happens? And this is where you have to go back to what I was saying yesterday about the intention and the motivation behind your actions. What are the roots, that kind of other root driving force that make us act in one way or the other? And that is ultimately what makes something either good or bad karma. So here, the idea of compassion is far more important than the actual killing itself. The killing is just the act. An act is neutral ethically. It all depends on where you come from, what actually makes that act a negative or positive karma. So, and this is of course extremely interesting because what it means is that it opens up the whole idea of Buddhist ethics enormously. And it means that we have a possibility, if you are a Buddhist or you follow Buddhist ethical ideas, you have a possibility of tackling modern ethical dilemmas in a very wise and a very kind of intelligent way. So, of course, one of the great modern ethical dilemmas that people talk about everywhere in the world is things like euthanasia. Is it okay if somebody begs you to turn off that machine? Please, I've had enough. Please turn off this machine. I've come to the last stage of my life. I don't want to be kept alive anymore. Is it okay, then, to turn it off out of compassion? Or is it not okay, then? Well, here is the answer, right? If you really are coming from compassion, of course, this is where you have to be careful, right? You have to really test where you're coming from. If you really are coming from compassion, then from a karmic point of view, it cannot be bad karma. Yeah, it's only if somebody don't want to die, if they don't want to die, of course, then there's a problem. But if people really, actually, I've come to the last stage, I have maybe a few days left, this terrible machine is keeping me going, I don't really want to be here anymore, please turn me off. And if you think, I don't like you at all, I'm going to make you suffer for a few more days, I'm going to keep the machine on, then keeping the machine on is actually bad karma, yeah. So this is the point here, it's really absolutely where we are, where we're coming from. So we have to be very careful, because these kind of situations are obviously very, very tricky. And sometimes you think that you're coming from compassion, but you are not really coming from compassion. Sometimes you just can't bear to see the suffering in the other person and all that kind of stuff. So you know that when you are going to possibly breach a precept and possibly do something that is on the edge of breaking the precept, you know that you're going to have to be careful. You're going to have to not go take a rush decision, take your time, and be sure that you know that you're coming from the right place. But if you feel reasonably sure of yourself and you feel that you know what you're doing, then you see that there isn't any major problem from a Buddhist ethical point of view here with that sort of thing here. Which is very interesting, because it kind of opens up an entirely new way of looking at things. Another interesting thing, which is, of course, one of those other major ethical dilemmas that I often talk about in our world, is things like abortion, for example. What is the Buddhist position on abortion? And it is actually very quite tricky from a Buddhist point of view, because there are so many factors that come into this. So I'll just kind of give you some ideas of how to look at this from a Buddhist point of view. So when it comes to abortion, of course, the first thing that you have to take into consideration is whether that fetus is conscious or not. Remember that Buddhist ethics is all about whether we inflict suffering on another being or not. So if the fetus in the womb is not conscious yet, if it's at the very early stages of a pregnancy, then of course if it's not conscious, it can't feel anything. If it can't feel anything, there's no bad karma in ending that pregnancy. So this is the first thing. So and this is very hard to know. How do we actually know whether a fetus is conscious or not? And this is actually one of those things that are very difficult to know, because first of all, the suttas are not clear about this. There are a few indications that maybe, but those indications themselves are a little bit uncertain as well. And if you know about what I'm talking about, we can even discuss those passages later on if you like. But it's very hard to know, and I think the reason why it is hard to know and there isn't anything laid down in the suttas is simply because it varies enormously when consciousness arises in the fetus. And because of that, it's very hard to actually tell. So this will have to be almost like a scientific investigation to decide whether consciousness is there or not. So this is the first thing, right? The second thing is how developed is that fetus? Of course, in the very early stages, there's hardly anything there. It's this kind of tiny little thing of matter, a few cells or whatever it is. And so to terminate a pregnancy at the very early stage, it's maybe a bit like, perhaps like killing an insect or something like that. It's a very minor thing. It is a very different from killing a fully grown human being, for example, which is far more serious because of the nature of the being that you're killing here. This is the other thing. So even if it is some negative karma there, it's very tiny. And the earlier in the pregnancy you do that, of course, the less bad it is. We're talking about something fairly insignificant regardless. And then the third factor which comes in here, and this is, of course, the intention of the person who does this, of the woman who decides that this is a right or not. So where are you coming from? Why are you doing it? Are you doing it purely out of kind of selfish concern? I don't want this at the wrong time or whatever. Or is it more a considered decision where you consider that, you know, all things considered, this is really not suitable and it's going to be cause enormous problems for so many people. And so again, so your intention there is also very important to take into account. So all of these things are things that you have to consider in this kind of thing here. And ultimately, nobody can really judge anyone else for having an abortion, because it is a personal decision, and only you can know for yourself whether what you're doing is appropriate or not, based on your intention. And nobody from the outside can really tell you whether what you're doing is right or wrong here. So that it gives you some clues about kind of how, a Buddhist point of view, on how to look at these kind of some of these ethical dilemmas. And of course, the same thing with things like stem cell research, where you might use very early, very basic embryos for stem cell research. It's a similar kind of thing, similar kind of ideas that you use to decide whether it's ethical, appropriate or not. So this is what I mean by Buddhist ethics being very flexible and very kind of very useful in this kind of ethical dilemmas, because that coming basically from intention and motivation is what decides whether these things are what they are not. So that then is the first part, the abandoning of killing living beings, which of course includes any kind of bad actions against living beings. It's much broader than really killing any kind of negative kind of consequences for other people is included in this, in terms of how we physically deal with them. So let's go on to the second one. The second one says here, abandoning the taking of what is not given He abstains from taking what is not given, taking only what is given, expecting only what is given. By not stealing, he abides in purity here. So this is, I think, fairly straightforward. Not to take anything which isn't kind of yours to take it. It says here, expecting only what is given, really, I think what it really means is wanting only what is given. Yeah, this is, now we're talking about monastics, of course, that is why you have this emphasis on things being given to you. But this idea of wanting only what is given, it kind of adds an extra dimension to this. Because it also starts to add in the idea of the mental side, the mental component of karma. Yeah, as you, not only are you not taking anything, you don't even have any desire to take anything. You can completely go beyond that to kind of expand that idea a little bit. And then, interesting, at the very end there, it says that by not stealing, you abide in purity. Yeah, so there is a degree of, I guess, felt impurity if you steal. You feel kind of slightly dirty and slightly kind of, you feel, it doesn't feel good afterwards. And of course, what is interesting about that, because here, as I said, we're talking all the way through here, we're talking about the two sides of karma, the negative karma and the positive karma. So if it leads to a feeling of impurity, if you steal, then the opposite of stealing, which is then, of course, the generosity or charity, leads to the exact opposite. It leads to a feeling of purity. Yeah. And this says something about the power of charity and generosity in the Buddhist teachings. It leads, and this is where you find this, we're going to have a look at this later on as well. You find this so many places in the suttas where generosity is one of those factors. I earlier talked about the reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha, but generosity is one of those factors at the very foundation of meditation that you use to reflect on it, to feel a sense of positiveness about yourself. You feel, yeah, I've been doing good things, I've been living well. And you reflect on those things, and it gives rise to a sense of joy and happiness and gladness in your life. And that becomes one of the forces that take you off into a deeper state of meditation. So generosity has this very powerful effect in Buddhism. And for that reason, it is something that everybody should try to kind of enhance in their life. Yeah, not just lay people for that matter, monastics as well. One of the great things about monastic life is that you have almost endless chances of being generous, because your whole life, you don't have any salary or anything like that. So anything you do, really, is an act of charity. Yeah, you go, whether you kind of, when we work in our monastery, we kind of do building work or whatever it is, when we do other kind of services, whatever it is, or even when we give talks or whatever it is, it's all really an act of charity. You do it because it feels good, because it's nice. And that kind of turns, this is one of the great things, I think, about monastic life. It makes the whole life so meaningful, in a sense. It has a very powerful sense of meaning. I could discuss that with Venerable Anal yesterday as well, very, very briefly here. It's a very meaningful existence, and the whole life is kind of turned towards generosity. So it's something we should all develop, because it can become such a powerful force for those basic qualities to fall into place on the Buddhist path. And the Buddha talks about this in many places. I'm not going to talk much about this. You can talk a lot about generosity, because there's so much material on that in the suttas. But some of the things that stand out about generosity. One of the places where the Buddha says that, this is from the Ittivuttaka, I think, which is one of the Kuddhaka Nikaya texts, and the Buddha says in there that if you know as I do the power of generosity, you would never have a single meal without sharing it with somebody. Yeah, you would never eat a single meal without sharing it with somebody else. Because if you knew the power of this, boy, you would take every opportunity that you have. This was probably spoken to the monastics, because, meal, that's pretty much one of the few things that we can share with somebody else. So very, very powerful. And I guess especially at the time in ancient India, where people would walk for arms around, people would have different food, right? And because you had different food, it would be nice to share. Here we all have the same food, we can't really share very much, doesn't make perhaps that much sense. But certainly, if you have something special, yeah, and you share that with somebody else, take every opportunity. Yeah. Another thing which always stood out for me when I was reading the sutta, there's a nice sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 9, I think it is, called the Vilama Sutta. And according to this, I think it's there, maybe I'm getting it wrong, I can't remember now. But I think it is in there, and it says that it talks about generosity, and the Buddha talks about how to make good karma with generosity. And he says that even if after you have washed your bowl, or you have washed the dishes, right, whatever it is, and there's a few scraps of food left over in the dishwashing water, like a few rice grains or a little bit like that, if you take that dishwashing water and you throw it out into your garden or onto the grass, into the bushes or whatever, with the thought, may those little insects who live on these kind of things, may they be happy with that. Even then, you're making good karma. Yeah, and this kind of shows you that if you are smart about this, there are so many opportunities. It's almost like you can turn anything into an act of good karma, into an act of generosity. It's all about how we think about things. And I often think about that when I, you know, people often talk about work, for example. How do we deal with work? Or, you know, work seems to be so, go against the Dhamma and all these kind of things. And sometimes maybe it does because, you know, I don't know, maybe the kind of pressure you're under and all these kind of things. But work is also an opportunity to do acts of generosity. When you work, you can either work with the idea, yeah, I'm going to do this to get my salary so I can pay my bills, right? Which is kind of, okay, fair enough. That's not really a problem. Of course, we have to do that. But you can also add something to that. You can go to work. You can think about the customers at the other end. You can think about your co-workers. And you can kind of give it that kind of additional little extra in your work, whereby you add that intention of doing something good for all those people who reap the benefits of the work that you are doing. Yeah. There's always people who reap benefits from what we're doing. Yeah. One way or another, you can either do your work sloppily, and if you do your work sloppily, then the end product is bad, and the customer is kind of not really satisfied. Or you can do it meticulously, think, okay, I'm doing out of compassion for my customer, and you kind of give them something else. Or helping out your co-workers, or whatever it is. So it's all in the attitude, and this is what the Buddha says, and the right attitude, anything we do, our whole life can really become life of generosity and kindness towards others. If we take every opportunity like that, wow, it becomes you go forward on this path really, really fast. So that is some of the things the Buddha says about generosity. Some of the other things that he says, which is very interesting, is the idea, for example, if you want to enter a deep state of samadhi, the only way you're going to be able to enter a deep state of samadhi is if you have a completely open heart, open-handed, willing to share, willing to give anywhere to anyone. Yeah. If you have any kind of sense of stinginess, of holding back, not willing to share with others, that is actually going to block you to enter into samadhi. Or same thing with kind of the attainments on the path. If you want to kind of have a deep insight into reality, you have to have that feeling of generosity inside of you. You can't be stingy, you can't kind of hold back on things. Yeah, and if you know the feeling of generosity, if you know what it feels like when you are really generous, when suddenly it's kind of, wow, I want to give to everyone. I'm sure many of you, maybe all of you, have that feeling sometimes, where kind of you just open up, you want to be so generous to everyone. And when you feel that, you know what a powerful feeling it is. You know that it is this must be a very spiritual feeling, because it has this very positive aspect to it. You know there's something very right about this. And you can understand why this kind of feeling is precisely the sort of stuff that will take you into jhanas. It's positive, it's happy, there's joy there, all these things coming together there. So that is the power of generosity. It is interesting that it is not actually mentioned here at all as in the gradual training. And I think it is almost taken for granted as being part of this, the opposite of of stealing. And I think the reason why it's not mentioned here is probably because it is so important that actually it is a topic on its own, and it's kind of mentioned so many other places in the suttas, how to give and all these kind of things. You find a lot of it in the suttas. There's actually quite interest in this whole area of giving, how to do it in the right way, where we should give, how we should give, all of these things are actually quite interesting And there's a lot about that in the suttas there. So if you want to know about that, you can ask me some questions in the evening, and we can maybe talk more about it then. We'll see what comes up during the rest of the retreat. So that is the second factor of right conduct. Now, one of the things to remember here as well is that I mentioned before that everything in the suttas is structured. Everything has a sequence, right? So when we start off with abstaining from killing, that is because that is the most important aspect in right bodily conduct. The second most important one is not stealing. The third most important one is the one we're coming to now, which is here translated as celibacy. And the same thing with right speech. Four aspects of right speech. The most important one being not lying, and then going down. The last one being idle chatter. So again, remember this hierarchy here, because then it kind of gives you an idea what is most important to focus on. These are not equivalent. There is a hierarchy here. So the third one here is abandoning in celibacy. He observes celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. But this needs a little bit of explaining, because the translation here is not perfect by any means. And it's not really in celibacy that we're dealing with. What we're dealing with is sexual activity altogether, of all types. That is what this means. So you ban the sexual activity is what this actually means. And then it says again, it has this word vulgar put in there. And just as before, I mentioned that the Pali word behind that is gammo. And gammo means literally of the village or pertaining to the village. In other words, it means ordinary, common. So it means the ordinary of common practice of sexual intercourse. That is what is meant here. So it's not meant to be a kind of a put down or saying that it is kind of particularly bad or anything like that. It's just meant to say that it is the common practice. If you want to practice something higher, that is where you abstain from that. That's kind of the idea behind this. And it's very interesting that this is part here of the gradual training. Again, this is for monastics. Of course, for lay people, it is slightly different. But it's interesting why it is there. Yeah, why is it the case that we have to abstain from all sexual activity? What is the point of this? And I teach the Vinaya, the monastic rules, to the monks at our monastery in Perth, in Australia. And we had the monks saying, why do we have to do this? Why is this a kind of rule? It was quite funny at the time, but it's actually a fair question. This is a reasonable question. Why do we have to do this? What actually is the point of all this? Isn't it just that we are giving up some harmless fun or some harmless enjoyment in life? Why do we have to give up enjoyment in life? What is the point of this? It's harmless if it is done responsibly. It's a harmless thing after all. And I think I mentioned some of this before, why this matters and why it is important. And why it is important is because one of the most powerful forces that keep us tied to samsara, to the wheel of rebirth, is precisely sensual pleasures. And of course, sexuality, being one of the most kind of the highest of the sensual pleasures, is particularly powerful. And because sensual pleasures always have to do with craving, always have to do with desire, always have to do with not really being satisfied in the present moment, always projecting us into the future. It's always about the future in one way or another. And because of that, it is this eternal projecting ourselves into the future. And every time you crave, and every time you follow up on that craving, you're actually building up more craving for the future, binding yourself to that wheel of samsara, keeping on going round and round and round. So the whole idea of sensual pleasures is the complete opposite of what we're trying to do on the Buddhist path, which is kind of getting off this wheel, the samsaric wheel. This binds you to that wheel. If you abstain from those things in the right way, it has to be in the right way. But if you abstain from these things and you are able to diminish those desires and cravings and go in different directions, then you will actually succeed in unbinding those knots that tie you to samsaric existence. So this is why this is one of the reasons why this is so important, because the most powerful ties to samsara are these. Is what we're talking about here. It's so common in the world these days, right? I meet people all the time. I was talking about the monks before, but this is far more common among lay people, of course. And people say, we want to have the best of both worlds. We want to enjoy ourselves, with all kinds of sensual pleasures. We also want to live the, you know, the spiritual life. We want to meditate and we want to have good samadhi and all these kinds of things. Everything together. Why do we have to choose one or the other? You monastics, you are outdated, right? This belongs to 2.5 millennia ago. This is the kind of monasticism. It's not for the modern world. That's the kind of argument you hear. But in my opinion, it's completely misconceived, complete misunderstanding of what the Buddhist path really is about. Because the point is that sensuality, on the one hand, and samadhi, real meditation, there is a degree of opposition between those things. Yes, you can have both to some extent, but there comes a point that unless you abandon one, you're not going to be able to have the other one. Yeah, there comes a point where your meditation is going to stop, it won't go any deeper, because you still have attachment to sensual pleasures. And when you think about that, it's actually very obvious. Yeah, if you are getting a lot of happiness in the world of sensual pleasures, and you find that that world is where, maybe that's where you find all your happiness, right? This is the vast majority of people, let's face it. That's where you find your happiness. If you find your happiness there, you're going to be attached to that. That is what it means to find your happiness in a place. It means that you are attached to those things. And if you are attached to those things, and you're trying to withdraw from those things in meditation, meditation is very largely a matter of withdrawing from the five senses and going inside of yourself. Ultimately, you have to let go of the five senses entirely. Now, if you are attached to the world outside, it means that you are attached to the five senses. You can't let them go, because letting go is the exact opposite of attachment. So this is why it is problematic, and this is why you cannot have both fully, because they move in two exactly opposite directions. So this is why, ideally, on the Buddhist path, you gradually, you kind of abandon some of an attachment to the senses, yeah? Some of the attachments to the body. And as you do that, you actually improve your meditation as a consequence. Yes, you are giving up maybe a little bit of the pleasures of the sensual world, but you are gaining another pleasure which is far more profound, far deeper, far more satisfactory. A pleasure that has nothing to do with craving, but with happiness in the present moment, right here, right now. And that is why it is really worthwhile doing it. It's not as if we are giving up all the pleasures in the world and getting nothing in return. In fact, if you do it in the right way, it's the exact opposite. You get it far more in return for what you're giving up. And this is kind of the point here. And this is why it should be a natural abandoning. We shouldn't force ourselves. Because if you force yourself to abandon one type of happiness and you haven't got the other type of happiness yet, you have nothing yet. And that's when life becomes absolutely meaningless. We all need happiness, yeah? We thrive on happiness or pleasure in one way or another. If we have no pleasure in life, life is completely pointless. And there's nothing really to live for anymore. So there has to be that natural movement. So you reflect on the dangers in one place, and you understand the happiness that is available somewhere else, and then your mind just naturally moves from one to the other one, without any effort, any willpower, no sense that you are giving up anything at all. It just happens almost automatically. This is the ideal. The reality is sometimes not quite as smooth as that, of course. When you come on the retreat, you take the 8 precepts, and sometimes you feel like it's a bit too much. You know, you have to realize sometimes when you're a monk, you've been a monk for 20 years. Of course, there are times when you think, okay, well, I can't bear this monastic existence right now. But, you know, overall, this is the idea. You move naturally from one to the other one. And over time, of course, things change in this way. So this is the idea, and this is why we have this, these kind of very, also very strict monastic rules, because it encourages you to seek your happiness in a different place, in a different area. And for monastics, it's actually quite strict. For example, you are not allowed as a nun or as a monk to just be alone by a member of the opposite gender. Yeah, that's why when I have these interviews over here, why. Bart was over there, yeah. Bart sits in there, right? So it's not to have that kind of, you make absolutely sure there's no kind of intimacy or anything like that happening in those kind of situations. So these rules are quite strict in this area. So anyway, so that is what that is about. So those are the three aspects of bodily right conduct on the gradual training. Yeah, so I Yeah, I think that is fairly complete. Of course, sometimes you may be able to think of bodily conduct that is not included in this. And of course, if it isn't, then of course what you do, you decide on the morality of it or the ethical nature of it just by looking at your intentions and motivations. And then you will know whether something is moral or ethical or not. So now let us have a look at the right speech, Sammavachana, the next factor here. And this is how it is described in the in his gradual training here. So abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. So this is all about lying. Yeah, so we try to avoid lying on the Buddhist path. And of course, here again, you have the opposite of lying, which is to be trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. So this is the kind of the opposite here of the idea of lying. And so it is not just about, again, you know, strictly speaking, not lying, but it's about actually being, you know, as reflective as the kind of, the way you speak reflects reality as much as possible. Yeah, so you are reliable and trustworthy. When you say something, people know they can take you on your word. They know what's going on. So again, here we see this vast thing from the worst kind of lie on the one end to the kind of most direct expression of the truth on the other end. And there's a whole scale in between there, kind of in various degrees of grey and various degrees of shades of grey all the way through there. And this is, again, it's an important thing to remember, because sometimes people take the precepts as very kind of square, right? Okay, lying is over here. As long as I kind of step 1 millimeter outside of line, it means I'm okay, then I'm fine. And some other people become like lawyers, right? They become, okay, this is kind of the lying is here. As long as I kind of stay kind of within the law, I don't kind of break that one, then I'll be fine. But karma isn't like law, right? Karma is different from law. It's important to understand that. This is also true of the monastic precept, because the monastic vinaya is really like a law. It's a monastic code. It's a legal code. And the legal code for the monastic, just as the legal code of the five precepts, tends to be square. You are either within the precept or you're outside of it. But morality, ethics, karma, is not as simple as that. For a legal code to work, you have to have kind of fairly clear boundaries. But for karma, there aren't any clear boundaries. It's all shades of grey and shades of various things. So the idea here is not to become a lawyer, because sometimes we don't want to say the truth, right? Sometimes we want to get out of things. So we kind of think, well, how can I avoid saying the truth without lying? This kind of stuff. And that is the way we become lawyers on the Buddhist path, and we kind of try to find little escape routes. So the idea here is to not just avoid lying, but actually be reliable and trustworthy, and not be as legalistic about this rule as people sometimes are. So you may think, what does that mean? Does that mean that, you know, what about times when kind of telling the truth is really difficult? How do we do that? What about if we hurt somebody by telling the truth? Yeah. And of course, there are times when telling the truth directly out is not really appropriate. Sometimes we may hurt somebody if we kind of blurt out the truth. You know, yeah, I'm going to tell you what you really are like, right, or something like that. But of course, that's not even the truth in the first place, because that's just our perception of the situation. So it also depends on your motivation. What is your motivation for lying? And motivation for lying is so vast, but very often the motivation will be somehow self-centered. It is self-centered because we don't want to tell the truth, because we are afraid of the consequences. Yeah, that is the worst kind of lying, when it's self-centered, looking after me and my interest, or looking after the interest of somebody else. And the classic example that is straight out of the suttas is the example when you go to a court of law, and the judge says, okay, we want to hear the truth, the full truth, the, you know, the absolute truth and nothing but the truth, or whatever it is. And then you say, despite the fact that you know exactly what the truth is, you say exactly the opposite, but you have sworn on the Dhammapada, I'm going to tell the full truth, right? No need to swear on the Bible for Buddhists, swear on the Dhammapada, swear on whatever it is that you'd like to swear on. And then you still, having done that, you lie. And usually the reason you will lie is because of some selfish purpose. Yeah, you are afraid of your ego is getting hurt, or you're going to lose something, or it's somebody in your family, a friend, right, who is in trouble, and then you kind of lie for some kind of small, insignificant, stupid little thing. Yeah. This is a bad, really bad kind of lying, which is kind of a really doesn't have any basis, and you know, it's completely against the Dhamma, really. Yeah. But then there is a kind of the lying where you know that the person you're talking to is going to be very hurt if they hear the truth. So you said, this is not the right time, there may be another time. You don't actually have to outrightly lie, you just tell them, well, I don't want to talk about that now, this is not the right time for this, and that sort of thing. And of course, that situation, it is very different, because there you actually have a wholesome motive behind this. Your wholesome motive is to shield somebody from something which might be too difficult. So right speech is often very tricky. We have to negotiate all these various things. And there are also perhaps certain situations when outright lie may be acceptable. And this is a story, again, this is one of Ajahn Brahm's stories, and this, I think, is a nice story which kind of illustrates this point very well. And this was a story of a medicine from Perth, and it was a man in hospital, and he was sharing a room with somebody else, and they were both waiting to have a bypass operation. Yeah, bypass operations, usually these days, they're quite safe, but occasionally something goes wrong and the person dies. So they're both sitting in this room together, and one day his friend, he goes first, and he goes in and he has his operation, and he doesn't come back. Yeah, so he's getting a bit worried, how come he doesn't come back? And then his wife comes to visit him in hospital while he's there, and then he asks his wife, what happened to my friend? He hasn't come back, he went to the operation, I haven't seen him afterwards. And his wife, she happens to know that he died on the operation table. Yeah, it was one of those small percentages that didn't make it through the operation. But she also knows that if I tell my husband now that his friend died, chances are he will get very anxious and very concerned. Yeah, so she tells him, oh yeah, no problem, you know, he's okay, he just, you know, he's somewhere else or whatever. So she actually outrightly lies to him. But in that kind of situation, you can see how it's a fairly reasonable thing to lie, because basically, otherwise, you're endangering the life of your husband if you tell the truth, if you blurt it out in that kind of situation. But this is the sort of thing, right, where we have to be very, where these rules have much more flexibility than we ordinarily allow them to have. And in the end, we have to come back to our own motivation and why we're doing things. That is what really decides whether something is ethical or not. So please use these rules not as completely kind of strict things, right? Never lie, never do this. Understand that there is some flexibility built into these things. Think of these rules like red lights. Yeah, so okay, if you're about to break a rule, okay, red light, stop, think, reflect. Is it appropriate to break this rule in this situation? And if you decide that yes, you're coming from the right motive, then it may be okay to do so. But be very careful, right? Because sometimes the mind is very tricky. The mind will say, yeah, yeah, no problem. You can go ahead in this case, right? Yeah, no worries. That's what they say in Australia. No worries. Just go for it. But the mind is very tricky, because the mind will rationalize things that you really want to do. And for that reason, you have to be very careful in those kind of situations. So how do you know that you are making a good decision in these kind of situations? This is another thing that people often ask. How do you make decisions in life? And this is a classical example. If you're going to break a precept, how do you actually make that decision and you know that it is the right decision? And the way, one of the most important ways of doing that is to know the state of your mind. What does your mind feel like? Do you have some desire in your mind? Is there some confusion there? Is there some kind of ill will? Or is there a degree of clarity? Is there a degree of calm? Are you kind of standing back and looking at this with a sense of calm clarity? That is one of the most important ways of knowing whether you are able to make a good judgment or not. If the mind is full of defilements and problems, all kinds of things, the chances that you will make a good judgment is very, very low. If the mind is clear, you're calm and peaceful, and those kind of factors are there, then the chances that you will make a good judgment are much, much higher. Right? Often we ask ourselves, can I trust my intuition or not? Is intuition, is that a good thing to trust? And it depends. Sometimes intuition is great. Sometimes intuition is rubbish. Yeah? And intuition is rubbish if your mind has defilements in it, because then the intuition will be colored by those defilements. You're going to do what the defilements want to do. But if you have a calm and peaceful mind, you have a degree of clarity, etc., then usually intuition is a very powerful tool on how to make decisions. Because sometimes our intuition of what is right is actually much more reliable than a kind of the rational mind. The rational mind often can take you astray far worse than the intuition can. But only if you use intuition at the right time. Often we have to use rationality and intuition together, of course, and then you get kind of the best results, perhaps. Okay, so anyway, that's a little bit about lying, and again, remember this vast areas here of of different types of lies. This is not a simple matter, either you lie or you don't lie. Here. Let's look at the next one here. Abandoning malicious speech, he abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here, in order to divide those people from these. Nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere, in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, the promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord or harmony, rejoices in concord and harmony, delights in concord and harmony, a speaker of words that promote harmony. Yeah, it's some of these very beautiful ways of talking about right speech on the Buddhist path. Malicious speech here is often also called divisive speech. Speech that divides people, where you tell one person about another person's bad qualities. See, that person is bad, right? They are really bad. And of course, when we do that, when we talk about one person's bad qualities to somebody else, we're giving that other person a bad impression. And that will tend to divide those people apart. Again, there's a large number of degrees in which this tends to happen. It's a very common thing among human beings, how we talk negatively about people. It's so common. And sometimes it's perhaps also unavoidable. I was mentioning yesterday, and I just actually looked up that sutta afterwards. I mentioned the sutta where the Buddha says that the person who talks praise about somebody who is worthy of dispraise, or blame if you like, or somebody who dispraises somebody who is worthy of praise, they create a lot of bad karma because of that. But somebody who speaks dispraise of somebody worthy of dispraise and praise of somebody worthy of praise, in both cases, they generate a lot of good karma. So, in other words, there is a time to speak dispraise of somebody. Yeah, if we know that there is something wrong going on, something bad going on, then of course we have to warn other people to not get themselves into a bad situation. Yeah, so this, of course, is important. Otherwise, if there are scallywag means like bad, right? It means like a kind of a dodgy, bad teachers out there, or whoever it is, and we don't warn them about these bad teachers or whatever, then, of course, other people are going to suffer the consequences. Yeah, and, of course, we know that there are such things in the world. There are, dodgy gurus and that kind of stuff. We find this all the time. You can go searching on the internet for dodgy gurus. I haven't actually tried the word dodgy as a guru, but if you look for these things, they are available. I was looking at one the other day, which would look really, really dodgy to my eyes anyway. And there's all kinds of abuse and all kinds of things going on, of course, in those kind of situations. And of course, within spiritual circles, it is then important that we warn each other of those kind of potential problems. And the same thing in life more broadly as well. Yeah? So when somebody is worthy of this praise, then sometimes it is right to speak out. But we have to be very careful, because most of the time when we dispraise or blame somebody, it's not because they are actually worthy of it. Most of the time it's because we have a grudge, right? We feel negative about something. And because of that, that's why these things come out. So generally speaking, you want to speak words that promote concord and bring harmony and bring people together. And that is so useful, I think, in our modern society. We're so often so divided, right? Divided, religion against religion, country against country. it's so divided on so many different levels. And if we can have more harmony between each other, harmony between countries, harmony between different cultures, and harmony regardless of who we are, young and old, and male and female, and whatever it is such a wonderful thing, because then things are so much more smooth in society. Things go so much more easily. That's when meditation becomes possible. If you haven't got harmony with the people around you, there's no way your meditation is going to work out. The Buddha specifically says that harmony is one of the causes for samadhi to be possible. If there is no harmony within the community, especially within oneself, then of course samadhi, meditation itself, becomes impossible as a consequence. So, there you are. And interesting here that this idea of creating harmony between people in this fourfold scheme of right speech is actually more important than gentle speech versus harsh speech. So divisive speech that divides people is considered worse karma, if you like it, on the Buddhist path than harsh speech, which is the next one. Okay, so let's go to the next one. It says here, abandoning harsh speech, he abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by the many, and agreeable to many. And again, one of those, to me, I think very, very beautiful the way it is put here by the Buddha, the idea of pleasing to the ear. Pleasing to the ear is kanna sukha. In Pali, sukha means happiness, right? So happiness to the ear, that's basically what it means. There's happiness to the ear. It is lovable, go to the heart, hadaya gamma, literally means going to the heart, exactly the same expression as you have in English there. Elsewhere, harsh speech is said to be leading away from samadhi, right? It's specifically said that of all the four factors of wrong speech, harsh speech is the one that leads away from samadhi. Interesting, right? Because it's not supposed to be the worst kind of karma. The other karmas are probably worse. So why is harsh speech singled out in that way? And I would say that because of its immediate effect, that would be my guess. It has a very powerful immediate effect right here and right now. If you speak harshly, it has a very kind of strong detrimental effect on your mind. In the long term, it may not be so bad, but in the immediate thing, it is actually has a very negative effect. So remember that. And it's very nice when we are together with people who speak gently, right? It kind of feels good. We feel kind of at ease in their company, all these kind of things. Whereas people who speak harshly, especially if that harshness comes from ill will, that sort of thing, it's often very unpleasant. And sometimes you just want to get away from those people as quickly as you can, because it's just not nice at all. So it is a very beautiful thing. It's a nice gift again to give to other people when you speak in a gentle way. And then the last one, abandoning gossip. It says gossip is not really quite right. Abandoning idle chatter, right? Empty chatter is a better way of putting this. He abstains from idle chatter. He speaks at the right time. Speaks what is fact. Speaks on what is good. Speaks on the Dhamma and the discipline. At the right time, he speaks such words as are worth recording. Reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. Again, very nice the way this is put. The idea of speaking at the right time. This is one of those things that is often very tricky. What is the right time? The right time is when the other person is open to listening to you. Or when something needs to be said urgently or something like that. But very often we speak because we need to speak. We're coming from our own kind of sense of self. I need to speak now. And sometimes that need to speak is driven by defilement. The defilement can be very compulsive. Ill will says, speak now. Now is the right time to speak. You need to speak. You need to sort things out. Yeah? Very compelling. Or desire may also similarly compel you to speak, drive you forward in that direction. So instead of speaking at the right time, we speak at the time when kind of we need to, often driven by motives that aren't necessarily 100% wholesome. To speak on what is fact, on what is good, on Dhamma and the discipline. Discipline here really means is the vinaya, and the vinaya in the early suttas mean more like training than discipline. So it's a training. In other words, it's a training in meditation, the training in morality, and that sort of thing that it really is about. The word discipline has a kind of slightly harsh feel to it, for most people, at least in English, probably most European languages, sounds kind of hard. Sounds like some kind of a military thing, right? You have discipline in the military. Sounds a bit like that. But it's not really what it's meant. It's more like a training, a learning, and especially learning through wisdom. Discipline often has this idea of willpower again, whereas the training in Buddhism, ideally, is a training using wisdom to achieve results. And one other thing I want to point out later on is that if you use wisdom rather than willpower, it is far more effective and far more useful in going forward on the path. This is one of those fundamental things that is actually very, very useful to be aware of. And then you speak at the right time, such words as are worth recording. The Pali here is Nidanavati. Nidanavati means to be treasured. Words that are to be treasured. Kind of words, when you hear them, you read the word, I think, wow, that's really beautiful. You hear a nice verse, you hear a nice simile, you hear a nice metaphor being used somewhere, and you take it in because you find it really powerful. I'm sure you've all had that sometimes. You read the word of the Buddha and you see a simile, you think, whoa, that is really powerful and beautiful. And then you remember it because of that. It's treasurable, to be treasured. And you kind of bring it with you and you bring it into the future and remind yourself of these beautiful words when the time is right. Then it's reasonable. It is backed up by reason. It is not kind of nonsensical words. They are moderate. Moderate means they don't go on forever, right? You talk not too long. But this is what I have to be careful with the time here, not to moderate myself. The last one is that it is beneficial for the person. And this is the last factor here. So one of the things that is missing from this whole scheme here is the idea, what about sometimes you have to say something to people that they don't want to hear, but it might be beneficial for them. Other people might feel that perhaps you are speaking harshly because they don't want to hear something. So is that good or is it bad if we say something beneficial that they don't want to hear? And the answer is sometimes we have to do that. That's part of life. Sometimes people need to hear something that isn't very pleasant, but there is no choice because there is a real problem there. And then we do say it, but we say it at the right time, with the right intention, coming from a sense of compassion and metta, rather than coming from ill will and negativity. And then it is okay. If it is beneficial, then it is okay to do that. And there's a nice simile. The Buddha gives a simile for this. He says this is where he's talking to one of the prince called Prince Abhaya, and he says to this prince, he says that, well, if you have a small child, and that small child is choking on something, right, it can't breathe because it kind of swallowed something the wrong way, what would you do? Would you even go so far as to put your finger down its throat and pull out that thing which it is choking on? And the prince says, of course I would do that, even if you draw blood, you would do that. Why? Because the short-term harm means long-term happiness. In the same way, if something is unpleasant for a disciple, the Buddha may lay down a rule. It's not as if the monks want more rules, right? They want less rules. But the Buddha says, okay, here is another rule, because you have been naughty or whatever, you haven't been doing the right thing. So please follow this rule from now on. And then that is how you do something which is beneficial in the long run. But of course, in the short run, maybe negative. So that is okay. So again, it's about being reasonable here, because otherwise you're kind of hamstringing your ability to function in the world if you take these things the wrong way. Okay, so that is all for now. So please keep on enjoying yourself, have a nice meal, and we'll see you back again today at 3:00 p.m.